Talking to a fella, he told me he was a mechanic. He said he'd been a mechanic for 30 years. I said, well, I guess you've seen a lot over the course of 30 years. He said, you can't imagine some of the things that I've seen. I said, tell me the most significant thing or the most interesting or unusual or terrible, whatever it is. What was it? He said, well, I was in the shop one day, and he said, people bring their cars by for just general maintenance and service. And he said, a lady pulls in, and she's got this gorgeous vintage car. And he said, it is spotless, gleaming. And I thought, man, whoever restored that car did a fantastic job. He said, he looks in, and he sees that the lady driving the car is an elderly woman. And so he goes up to the car and he opens the door and she gets out. And she said, my car's not running quite right. He said, well, let me see what I can do to help you because you have a beautifully restored vintage car. She said, oh, it's not restored. She said, this has never been painted. She said, my husband bought this car brand new, and I don't know what it was, 30 years ago or something like that. And she said, shortly thereafter, he died. But she said, he loved this car. And he told me, don't ever get rid of this car. Something happens to me, don't ever get rid of this car. It's kind of like what spouses say to each other. Now, if I die, don't you ever marry anybody else. It's kind of the way she felt about it. You know, he'd put that burden on her. And so she said, I've just kept it in the garage and taken care of it all these years. And she said, I don't put very many miles. He leaned in, looked at the odometer, and it was almost, I think he said it was almost 25 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood. It was an older car, but it only had like 60,000 miles on it. And he said, well, what's wrong with it? Why isn't it running properly? She said, well, I'd taken it down to have it detailed. She said, I have it detailed every month. It's hard to imagine how much wax was built up on this car. And she said they detailed it inside and out. And the guy that drove it back to me told me that it wasn't running quite right. So she said, I don't know really what's wrong. She said, it's just not running like it's supposed to. He said, well, when was the last time you changed the oil? And she said, excuse me? And he said, you know, general maintenance, change the oil, check the fluids, things like that. Oh, you're supposed to do that? She said, I've never changed the oil. He said, well, tell you what. He said, I'm going to have a lady in the office drive you home, and I'll call you when we have some idea of what's going on or what it may take to fix it. He said that when he opened the drain plug on the oil, nothing would come out, and he was fearful that there was no oil in it at all. Until he pulled the drain pan or the oil pan, and he said he scooped the oil out like peanut butter. Cleaned it up, got everything, all the fluids changed, everything put back the way it's supposed to be, and he said it ran fine. But he said it was just amazing to me that on the outside, everything was gleaming and shiny and beautiful. And on the inside, it was dying. Here's the lesson that we learn from that. Looking good on the outside may be one thing. But if the inside is not good, that's an altogether different thing. In fact, I would suggest to you that having everything looking the way it's supposed to on the outside, while everything on the inside is dying, is useless. The Bible speaks of this as hypocrisy. And it is something that we in our present day have elevated to a whole new level We've made a science out of it. We have learned how to put on the appropriate appearance. We know when to say the right words. We know when to do the right things. We can walk, and people think that as we talk, everything is just fine. But on the inside, everything is dying. Jesus knew this about us, and it's not new to our generation. It is something that has been present for a very long time. And not only is it killing us today, it was killing people then as well. In Luke chapter 11, some of the harshest words that we hear from the Savior are directed at this very subject and issue. In verses 37 through 54, we learn that external action without regard for internal condition is something that is going to ultimately lead to not only hypocrisy, but to dying inside. Let's look at the first few verses, and it kind of sets the story for us. While Jesus was speaking, a Pharisee asked him to dine with him, so he went in and reclined at table. The Pharisee was astonished to see that he did not first wash before dinner. And the Lord said to him, "Now you Pharisees, cleanse the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. You fools, did not he who made the outside make the inside also? But give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything will be clean for you." Now the story continues, and this is a continuation of the previous verses that Craig shared with us last week. And so everything is just kind of following the same chronological line, and it's the same setting. The Pharisee has invited Jesus to join him for dinner. And so they go in together to recline at table. And as they do, he does not first wash his hands. Now, this has nothing to do with hygiene. Washing hands for hygienic purposes in that day and time was an unknown thing. This has something to do with ceremony. And it doesn't have anything to do with biblical ceremony, because there is no biblical injunction about this. It has to do with the oral traditions of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. These oral traditions are an expansion of God's law. So God gives directives in the Old Testament. We can see them and read them still today and understand exactly what their intent and purpose is. But along the way, what happened was that this ruling body of religious and governmental leaders expanded on this, and this oral tradition developed. It had been with them for so long that now entire classes of people have sprung up in order to teach or to instruct or to issue ruling on all these rules and regulations and details of how we are supposed to live. When you read some of the writings of the Pharisees and some of the things that have been recorded about hand washing, for instance, it is staggering. The hand washing was ceremonial only, but it was to be done in a certain way. So there is a law that has been written, not just an oral one, but a written law. And it says that when you wash your hands, if you pour the water from the wrist down, then the hand shall be clean, unless you use the hand to apply the water to the other hand that hasn't been cleaned, and then both hands are now unclean. If you pour the water from above the wrist so that it runs down across the hand, it shall be clean. But if you pour the water from here, having already cleansed the hand and it has become unclean again, then the whole arm is unclean. If you need to dry it and you wipe it on your cloak or on the wall, that shall still be clean. If you touch another person before they have washed, it is unclean. Now, do you know how long it took me to memorize that? It makes me kind of want to throw up a little in my mouth just to think about it. This is what regulated people. This is what guided them. And this, just about the one element. But there were many elements. But every element of life was governed this way. It is impossible to imagine living under this kind of weight of responsibility and knowing the imperfection that exists in us all, so that what would have to occur is we would have to get to a place where we stop really being changed by anything meaningful and we live our entire existence for public appearance. That's all that matters. Doesn't matter who you are, it just matters what people perceive you to be. That is a miserable way to live. But that's what had happened. And that's where they were. Jesus goes in. He doesn't wash his hands. It's not a biblical law. He's not going to participate in their foolish ceremony. And it says that the Pharisee, upon seeing this, is aghast. He cannot believe it. He is amazed. How could you call yourself a leader and teacher of God's truth and yet not follow ceremony? Keep in mind, again, the ceremony he speaks of is the traditions of men. It has nothing to do with biblical truth. It has nothing to do with God's teaching. You will not find anything about this anywhere in the Bible, nor in extra-biblical material in the Jewish writings. It just doesn't exist. It was an oral tradition. In other words, it was something that had been practiced and now practiced and now practiced until finally it has become accepted. Nobody knows when it started. Nobody knows why we do it. And nobody knows how to change it. But Jesus does. He's just not going to do it. He is amazed that he doesn't wash. But Jesus perceives this. The Lord said to him, "You Pharisees cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside it's full of greed and wickedness." He's not talking about the fact that they were washing only the external of the cup. He was talking about the cup as an example of what they were like. You spend all this time making the outside look good, but on the inside you're full of greed and wickedness. You're self-serving and you are filled with sinfulness. You have no concern about what's on the inside. You care only about the outside. And we see this over and over. It would be too easy to start pointing fingers at this kind of thing. What we need to hear this message speak into our hearts is the way this impacts each one of us, because there is not one of us that is immune from the reality of this condition. All of us spend way too much time focused on the externals while ignoring what is within. He says, if you want to fix it, give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. In other words, take your sinfulness, take your greed and your wickedness, take your brokenness and your foolishness, and give that as an offering to God. Confess your sin, acknowledge your weakness, recognize your limitation, and stop trusting yourself and stop following the lemmings. Be different. Listen to the Spirit's voice. Give that as alms, and you will experience the cleansing. When we confess our sin, what happens? We agree with God about what is wrong in us. That's all confession is. It's not about informing God, nor is it about informing those that you confess to. It is about us coming to the place of agreement. It is recognizing we have a problem and saying, "God, save me." He says, do that and everything will change. But he doesn't stop there. Jesus, rather than trying to explain himself with regard to the washing, launches in to an attack on the Pharisees. He goes on the offensive in a way that we've not seen up to this point. In verse 42, he attacks them for their preoccupation with the trivial while neglecting what is most important. He said, "Woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others." They were really very fixated on tithing. And the Pharisees not only taught it, because that was where they derived their income from the gifts of the people, but it also was something that they didn't want to tithe more than 10%. So they were very specific. So when he says you tithe these herbs, this mint and the rue, what is he talking about? He's talking about the seasoning that went on their food. So they would take the seasoning and they would separate it out before applying it. And then they would use, I guess, an X-Acto knife or something to cut away 10%. And then that would be set aside for God, and the rest of it would be put on the meal. Imagine if you have a shaker of salt and pepper sitting on the table, and you're going to apply that, but before you do, you want to put 10% of it aside for God. Now, number one, God doesn't want your salt and pepper. By the way, it's already His. What He wants is your heart and your soul. God doesn't want your show of piety. He wants the depth of righteousness that flows from a heart surrendered to Christ. But they were all about this show. And so every action, every meal, every event was an opportunity for them to display their righteousness before others and to lord it over them. He says to them, "Woe to you. For while you are focused on these trivial matters that mean nothing, you neglect justice. You neglect those who are hurting and those that you are hurting, in fact. And you neglect love for God. Neglecting justice, which is loving others, neglecting love for God, which is in and of itself the very foundation and the highest action of the believer, is to say that you focus on the trivial while ignoring what is most important. We all have a tendency to do that. Why? Because the trivial is easier. It's easier to X-Acto knife your herbs than it is to give your life to someone who's hurting. He calls upon us to deal with our preoccupation with trivial and traditional and stop neglecting the focused attention on loving God and loving others. What does it look like when we love God? It will look like love for others. When you love God, you will love one another. You can't do otherwise. If the problem is brokenness in your love for one another, then the solution is a deeper, lasting, genuine love for God. Love for God means that we put Him first. What does that look like? Is that Bible study? Is that prayer? It can be. But love for God has to go beyond those actions that you do, because the danger in talking about hypocrisy, traditionalism, Pharisaism, and this sort of rote and routine religious behavior, the danger is that whatever the solution we come up with is we turn it into another list of rules and regulations. I'm not talking about rules and regulations. I'm talking about a relationship. A relationship that flows out of a heart of love. Best way I know for me to come into a deeper contact and connection with the love of God is to see that love on display. And the highest display of God's love is Jesus on the cross. And the awareness that Jesus died for me, my sins, those that I knew about when I first made my confession, those that I have become aware of and that I still struggle with today. In seeing the brokenness, the limitations, and the failings that we all experience, and understanding that His grace still abides. The love of God cannot be known apart from the sacrifice of Jesus. Love for God, love for others are the things that they were neglecting all the while being religious. Is it enough? Secondly, he says, "Woe to you Pharisees, for you love the best seat in the synagogues and the greetings in the marketplace." Concern with public recognition was so dominant in the life of the Pharisees that it even extended to church. We were talking about this morning that Mackenzie Monte and Stephen Schatz are getting married in Mexico. And so all the Schatz clan's gone. And so Katie and Nathan came over and sat in their seats. So when the Schatz come back, you tell them, Katie and Nathan, and it was Katie's idea, and they sat in their seats. And so it's funny how we get so patterned, you know. We find our spot and we kind of settle in, and that becomes the routine. Well, there's not really anything wrong with that in and of itself. But for these people, that was not just a matter of routine, it was a matter of recognition. And so it wasn't just sitting in the synagogue in the same spot, it was sitting in the most honored spot. In a Baptist church, the most honored spot is the back seat, but I think in the synagogue that was not the case. And so the most honored place was reserved for the teacher with the most renown. And so they jostled back and forth because they wanted public recognition. Jesus said, if all you want is the acknowledgement of men, then you have all you're going to get while you're on this earth. The acknowledgement of people and the agreement and the praise of men is not what we live for. But we live in order to serve to the glory of God. Woe to you, because you are driven by the public recognition and the vanity associated with it. If we take this and extend it beyond that, we can see that it has less to do in our own lives today, probably with public recognition, and more to do with peer perception. We are enamored with what others think of us. We want to know, and it drives everything that we do. So that rather than exploring who we are within and understanding who Christ has called us to be and made us to be, we are driven more about what people think, so that it becomes a preoccupation that completely guides all that we do and unsettles most of who we are. Thirdly, in verse 44, the third woe says, woe to you, for you are like unmarked graves, and people walk over them without knowing it. In this day and time, contact with a burial site was considered unclean, and that is in the Bible, by the way. And so to prevent people from inadvertently doing that, tombs where people were buried would be whitewashed to make them visible. And so that way people could avoid that contact. He says to the Pharisees, you're like unmarked graves. You're causing corruption among the people who inadvertently are having contact with you. You're causing corruption as a result of the people entering into these relationships with you, or are listening to the teaching, or following your advice, or falling under the thumb of your oppression. And he says, on the inside of you is death. And now it's infecting like a contagion those around you, so that all of you are becoming nothing more than this walking dead of people that are going through the course of life without any value, purpose, significance, or anything left on the inside. This was a really, really harsh statement for him to make to the Pharisees, and it left no room for doubt as to what he intended. What are we doing? Are we salt? Are we light? Or are we death and corruption? Are we saying to the world, come to us and let us help you know Jesus. Let us show you how Jesus has changed us. Or are we saying to the world, come to us and be like us? And if you're not going to be like us, then don't come to us. I realize it's a fine line, but it is one that we need to explore daily to remind ourselves of the purpose for which we exist as Christians and as a church. And it is not to spread death, but it is to spread life and hope. Do you realize that currently in the Southern Baptist Convention, it is estimated that almost 40 churches a day are closing. Now, is that bad? Well, in some cases it is. In some cases, maybe it's not. Maybe they've merged with another church, or maybe the community has so changed that there's just no one there, but those people are still going to church, just doing it somewhere else. I think some of those situations could be present in those numbers. But in some situations, There are churches where people have looked around and said, we realize that in order to reach the city around us, to reach the community around us, in order to reach people, that some things are going to have to be different, but I hate difference. And there are churches who have chosen to die rather than recognize the need around them. There are churches that have maintained a whites-only mentality while still existing in a community that has completely changed around them and has become ethnically diverse. So rather than the church reaching out to those ethnic groups who are lost and those people within those groups who God has called out to minister, they maintain what they once were, even though it isn't who they are at all anymore. And so there's an outward, external, focused attention on an appearance, while on the inside it's death. And everyone who becomes a part of it, if anyone chooses to, is corrupted by it as well. He said to the Pharisees, you are like unmarked graves. But then the tone changes and the story shifts just for a moment. In verse 45, one of the lawyers answered him, teacher, in saying these things, you insult us also. Lawyers were not people who were responsible for legal matters within the governmental system, as opposed to the Pharisees who were responsible for those matters within a religious system. Lawyers were Pharisees, probably. And they weren't lawyers in the sense that we understand that term today. They would have been people who were experts in the law. So you could be a Pharisee and not necessarily be an expert in the law. But you could not be a lawyer as an expert in the law and not likely be a Pharisee. Pharisees would have been from all walks of life, professional religious leaders, but also lay people. They may have been business owners or things of that nature. Lawyers, on the other hand, would have been highly trained theologians. And that's all they did. And so the lawyer who was present at the meal speaks up and he says, Jesus, can you tone it down a little bit? Because we're all starting to feel a little uncomfortable and it's getting awkward in here. And in fact, we kind of take offense at what you said. Well, kind of like gas on a fire, Jesus said, woe to you lawyers also. For you load people with burdens that are hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. Making faith a burden rather than a blessing is what happens here. So he turns his attention to the lawyer and he says, you're no better. In fact, you're no different. And you've taken all the matters of faith and you've loaded them on the backs of the people. And yet you have done nothing to help them understand that truth and to embrace it. So that now their faith is a burden. And all the joy of knowing Christ, all the joy of knowing God, all the joy of living for His glory is absolutely gone. How many times have we looked at church? Have we looked at faith and religion and said to ourselves, even if it wasn't out loud, it's more of a burden. Oh, do I have to do that? You think it's bad for you? You ought to grow up in a preacher's house. Especially one like my dad. My dad said, when church time is, we will be there if it's us four, no more. When it snowed on those rare occasions in East Texas growing up down there, he'd say, I don't care if it's tail deep to a tall giraffe, we're going to church. And we did. And all the other kids got to skip on Sunday night and watch the $6 Million Man. I've never seen the wonderful world of Disney. What is 60 minutes? I don't know. And so all of these things, a burden. Well, when you're a child or when you have the immaturity of childlikeness, that's one thing. And you see your friends and other people doing life a little differently than you, that's one thing. But once you put away those childish things, now you have a choice in how you perceive the world and how you respond to it. And if your faith is a burden and if your faith is an obligation, then what you have is something other than true faith. I don't know what it is, but it isn't what Jesus came to bring. Making faith a burden rather than a blessing was a reason for Jesus to pronounce woe upon them. In verse 47, he said, "Woe to you, for you build tombs of the prophets whom your fathers killed. So you are witnesses, and you consent to the deeds of your fathers, for they killed them, and you build their tombs. Therefore also the wisdom of God said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute, so that the blood of all the prophets shed from the foundation of the world may be charged against this generation, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, it will be required of this generation." So he says, here you are, you're out building monuments for the prophets, but you have no regard for their message. How do I know that? Because your forefathers killed the prophets, and their blood will be on your hands, because what have they done? They have already contributed to the death of John the Baptist. They will ultimately be the ones who will demand the blood of Jesus. They will be the ones who will stone Stephen. They will be the ones who will inspire the wrath against Christianity as it starts to grow. And they will be the ones that will give rise to martyrdom at its earliest stages. And so not only was he pronouncing a condemnation on the attitudes of those who'd gone before, but he was predicting sin of those who would come after. We listen to the message, but we don't hear it. So that rather than honoring the message of the prophets who constantly cried out one single message, repent and turn to God. We can build all the monuments we want, but if we do not honor the message, they are meaningless. Verse 52, he says, "Woe to you lawyers, you've taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering, so that they have removed the ability to understand." What is the key of knowledge? It is salvation. Salvation gives us the mind of Christ, the presence of the Holy Spirit within, so that we understand spiritual things. Paul says these things are spiritually discerned. Therefore, the key to understanding life, who you are, who you're supposed to be, why you have value, significance, and purpose, the key to understanding the world around you and the direction in which it is moving, and the ultimate consummation by which it will all come to a close, the key to understanding life and death and everything in between, is found in the relationship with Jesus Christ. This is not religious gobbledygook. This isn't just smearing something across the surface. This is significant. This is meaningful. This fits into a worldview. It fits into philosophy. It fits into the modern debate. It fits into the postmodern mindset. It fits wherever people are at whatever age we have been, because Jesus Christ has declared, "I am the same yesterday, today, and forever." God tells us there is no turning with Him. Therefore, when we look to Him, we see life the way it's supposed to be. When we don't, it's all messed up. He says, you've been given the key to help people understand truth, and you didn't do it. And now you've helped them move into false teaching. What was the response to the woe statements? As they went away from there, the scribes and Pharisees began to press him hard, to provoke him to speak about many things, lying in wait to catch him in something he might say. Here's your response. This is the way we all are. We're all like this. Listen for just one more minute. This is important. You've heard everything and you thought, we endured that, now we can get out of here. Yes, you can. And yes, you did. But if that's all you want is to get out of here, or to endure it, then that tells you all you need to know about where you are spiritually. It should tell you that what is most important to you is that you were seen here. You only care that you were seen here. You got credit. Collect your gold star, get your pat on the back, go your merry way. But if what matters most to you is a genuine life of faith, then you will heed what Jesus says. You will hear what the Spirit is speaking into you today. Because there isn't a single person in here, not one of us, that isn't a hypocrite. And the most vile of hypocrites is the one who denies his hypocrisy. What do you have to confess? That's not my deal. I've already got my own list. Don't look for a way to deny what Jesus says. Look for the opportunity to become like Jesus.